Good morning, everybody. I'm Chris Robertson, Vice President of LNG Infrastructure and Maritime Shipping at Deutsche Bank Securities, and welcome to Capital Link's Shipping Sector Webinar Series. So today we'll be discussing the latest trends, opportunities, and outlook on the LPG carrier market. And we have with us today Mr. Kristian Sørensen, CEO of BW LPG, Mr. Ted Young, CFO of Dorian LPG, and Mr. Mads Peter Zacho, CEO of Navigator Gas. The webinar will feature a roundtable discussion with our panelists, followed by a short Q&A session, and will run approximately 45 minutes. Participants may submit questions at any time using the Q&A button on the webinar platform, and we'll do our best to answer them during the Q&A segment. Please note that questions should only be focused on the LPG sector today. Please also note that these webinars are for informational and educational purposes only and do not constitute investment advice or any other form of advice. The views discussed during today's webinar do not necessarily reflect those of Deutsche Bank Securities. Lastly, this webinar is being recorded today on Wednesday, December 10th, 2025, and will be available later as an on-demand replay. Gentlemen, let's start with some introductions. Please introduce yourself, your company, and fleet, and describe what segments or segments of the LPG carrier you specialize or concentrate in. And we'll start with Mr. Sørensen.
Thank you, Chris. My name is Kristian Sørensen. I'm the CEO of BW LPG. We're the largest owner and operator of very large gas carriers, VLGCs. We operate in the same segment as Dorian and Ted's company. We have currently 51 ships owned or operated out of a global fleet of 413 ships on the water. And in addition to or as part of our fleet, you also have a subsidiary in India, which is the largest Indian-flagged fleet of VLGCs, currently counting 9 ships. And then we also have a trading branch named BW Product Services, which is becoming a meaningful part of our business and trades approximately 5-6 million tons of physical LPG per year. So that's a brief introduction of our company. We are listed in Oslo and on the New York Stock Exchange.
Thank you, Kristian. Ted, let's turn it to you.
Hi, Ted Young, CFO of Dorian LPG. We are solely active in the very large gas carrier segment. We have 27 ships in our fleet today. Again, and you know, plying the main trades between the U.S. Gulf and Asia, and the Middle East Gulf to Asia as well. And we operate from Copenhagen, where we do our post-fixture and chartering, Athens, where we do our own in-house technical management through our wholly owned subsidiary, and from Connecticut, where we who constitute the overhead sit. But that's finance, investor relations, IT, and the like. And we're listed on the New York Stock Exchange and have been since 2014.
Thank you, Ted. And finally, Mads.
Thank you. Mads Peter Zacho, CEO of Navigator Gas. Navigator Gas is the owner-operator of just over 60 gas carriers, including 6 on order. We are focused on handysize and midsize. 32 of our vessels have ethylene capability. We also have a 50% ownership in the world's largest ethylene export terminal. We carry LPG, ammonia, and petrochemicals, including ethylene. We have locations in all major regions, Asia, Europe, and North America, and we also trade globally.
Thank you, Mads. So you've introduced yourselves and your fleets primarily. Next, can you describe at a high level your company's approach to capital management, including returns, high-level strategy around fleet renewal and investment, and capital management as it relates to leverage and your balance sheet? And we'll just do the same order, starting with Mr. Sørensen.
Okay. BW LPG, for us, we acquired the Avance Gas VLGC fleet last year in the $1 billion transaction. So we had the major investment done last year, and for us, this year and also into the next year, it's more about putting our assets to work to generate earnings and dividend capacity as we find actually the asset prices currently being too elevated to invest in further in new ships for the moment. So we are focusing on returning shareholder value through dividend payouts, but we also have a share buyback program which we activate from time to time. We did it earlier this year also, but paying dividends is our primary means of returning value to our shareholders. When it comes to the leverage ratio, we have a net leverage reported last week for Q3 at just below 30%, which you can say is rather healthy balance sheet for a shipping company. And it's not an aim for us in itself to have low leverage, but it's also a reflection of the fact that we do struggle to find attractive investment opportunities for time being because of the asset prices, which we believe are too elevated at the moment to attract investments from our side.
Thank you. Ted?
Dorian's approach to really, you're talking about the three main uses of capital, right? Debt reduction, fleet investment, and hopefully growth, as well as shareholder returns. And striking that balance is really critical. We've been very happy to report that over the last 4 years, we've managed to strike pretty good balance between all three. So, net debt as a percentage of total capitalizations declined from 33% down to about 15%. But over the same time period, we've paid over $16 a share in dividends, and also managed to probably just before that time period did a $113 million share self-tender offer at $12.50 a share, which compared to our current price in the mid-20s and our all-time high in the 50s ended up being a good use of capital. We've taken delivery of one new building already in 2023. We're taking delivery of another one in the first half of 2026. So we kind of feel we've been able to serve all three masters. I'd say from a capital management, from a balance sheet perspective, from a return of capital perspective, rather, we as like Christian, I think prefer dividends. And for us, it's been an interesting corporate finance experiment. The corporate finance textbooks would tell us that there should be no difference between a dividend and a share repurchased. And in fact, we've done both, and we really saw no measurable impact on our total shareholder return when we did meaningful shareholder or meaningful buybacks. And yet, we saw, of course, a massive increase in shareholder return when we actually started paying dividends. And so, probably a lot of reasons behind that, but clearly, we will use both, although I'd say so far the preponderance of capital allocation has been towards dividends over buybacks. And look, at the end of the day, the goal here is to generate the best total shareholder return, and so we'll continue to evaluate the best way to do that over time.
Great. Mads?
Yeah, in Navigator, we've had a capital return policy since 2023, and we've returned $210 million since then through dividends and share buybacks. Last month, we increased our quarterly payout and fixed dividends. So we gradually renew our fleet. We are selling older vessels when they're approaching 25 years and buying mainly secondhand vessels. We aim to consolidate our segments through pay-for-steel acquisitions. And I think that's a model that has worked really well for us in the past. Navigator has a robust balance sheet. We have net debt to EBITDA of a comfortable 2.6 times and a loan to value that's below 30%. So I think we have the balance sheet strength to do more, both in terms of capital return, but also in terms of cautiously growing our fleet as we go forward.
Thank you, Mads. Just taking a step back here, this is for the benefit of our listeners here. There's many acronyms in this sector: LPG, NGL, VLGC, all these types of things. So let's take a step back and maybe talk about the different vessel size and classifications, your capability to load various types of specialized LPG, petrochemical or ammonia cargoes. So can you walk us through kind of the technical aspects of your fleets in terms of temperature control, pressure control, or other technical aspects of your vessels, and describe that how that relates to carrying certain cargoes?
I don't, Ted, we are in the same segment here. So would
Yeah.
you like to
You
give it
can
a go?
split. Yeah. I'll give it I'll give it a go and then you can correct me. BW and Dorian both operate in the VLGC, very large gas carrier sector. Our ships are all in this sector in the current day and age, sort of 84,000 cubic meters or above in carrying capacity. They're, 210, 220 meters long for those of you who were not that familiar with the sector. We really can transport three cargoes, propane, butane, and propylene, and a fourth as we go forward, I should say, ammonia. Technically, the cargo is, there are different ways to, transport a gas, either under pressure or by liquefying it with cold, and that's what the VLGC sector does. So we're fully refrigerated. We cool the LPG, we cool LPG to about minus 52 degrees. That's why the gas plant is the most important thing, and why the gas engineer is probably the second most important guy on the ship after the master, the captain. So I'd say it's a pretty technical operation. We're told by our seafarers who have been at sea with LNG vessels that an LPG carrier is actually more technically complex. Don't know, but it does speak to, I think, I think the complexity of the business that Dorian and BW are in. Christian, what did I miss?
I think that's right, we primarily load propane and butane, being the main
Yes.
LP, liquefied petroleum gases. The main loading regions are out of the U.S. and the Middle East, and the main market for, or consuming market for, LPG is in Asia. So it's a very shipping intensive trade that we operate in. I think it's fair to say that our ships are less advanced than Matt's vessels, which can carry numerous other commodities too. So I think that's, it's fair to give Matt's a minute or
Yeah.
two here as well.
Good. I can talk a little bit more about the handysize and the mid-size vessels. Those are the ones that we operate there, 20,000 to 40, 50,000 cubic meters, so smaller than the VLGCs. We mainly have what we call semi-refrigerated vessels that can both cool and compress the gas cargoes. 32 of our vessels are ethylene capable, so those are the most versatile ones that can carry cargoes down to more than a 100 degrees Celsius minus. Most of our vessels can carry all of LPG, ammonia, petchems, including ethylene and ethane. So currently we are cleaning up a couple of our ammonia vessels to carry petchems because that's what we get, where we get paid most for the time being. So we're switching between the different types of cargo with our vessels, and it really sits in the name Handysize, that they are very versatile and can do many different types of gases. But of course, the economics of scale are not in our favor for those products that can be carried on a VLGC. And that's really how we separate it, that where it makes sense and where you can get the economies of scale, you put it on a larger vessel. And when you need the flexibility and the shorter trades with smaller cargoes, that's when you come to us.
Great, thank you, Mads. It was brought up, Christian. You brought this up. I'm glad you did. Which is, where are these specific products being produced primarily, and where are they primarily in demand? And can you talk about the various products in terms of what is their end use? What are they being used for in the broader market in terms of input, output, if they're feedstocks, these types of issues. So.
Sure, I can start, and then Ted, the Mats, feel free to add on here. LPG is a byproduct of crude oil and natural gas production. So no one really drills for, LPG. It's something which is a part of the crude oil and natural gas wells. It's like I mentioned, the US is the biggest loading region for or loading area for the VLGC market for time being. Used to be the Middle East back in the days, which is still an important loading region for our market. LPG is primarily shipped to markets east of Suez, to Asia, where it's being used in two big demand centers. One is the residential markets, typically in India, Southeast Asia, and also other parts in Asia. And then you have further northeast in Asia. It's being used also as a feedstock for the petrochemical industry. But you also have other uses like industrial uses, auto gas. Marine fuel is now an increasing market for us. We have in our fleet 19 owned vessels which use LPG as marine fuel, and a couple of others more in the pool. So this is showing how versatile the LPG is in terms of usage and demand centers. So it's a very good underlying commodity story, which has fueled the shipping market over the last 6, 7, 8 years, because this trade from especially from the US to Asia is a very shipping intensive trade. So that's what Ted and we also have benefited from for quite some time now, and the same goes for navigated gas. So you have this dislocation between production, especially in the States, and the big consumer markets in Asia, which has been to our advantage from a shipping point of view. Ted, is there anything we should add here?
Maybe just a couple more details, because I think you covered it well. Just to put it in context for the listening audience, you know, the two main segments, like the Christian outline, which is residential commercial, which is heating and cooking, and pet chem, probably constitute together 75 to 80 plus percent of world LPG consumption. And so the interesting aspect about the first segment there is it's relatively stable. It tends to grow with population growth and global GDP. You know, if, as, and when LNG makes inroads, then yes, we'll lose a little bit of market share. But frankly, it's been a great up and to the right growth story because it's a clean gas and it's much better for a lot of folks in the emerging markets' health, because instead of cooking with a lot of smoke in an enclosed place, burning biomass, they're burning clean LPG, which is cheap and easy to transport. I think, you know, within the petrochemical sectors, there are two subsegments. One is LPG, sorry, is traditional steam cracking. And we'll come on to it later, I think. There's an arbitrage between LPG and naphtha. Whichever is cheaper, the steam cracker operators will try to increase that percentage of the feedstock slate. And it's not huge. It can be up to 15% on old crackers and up to 30% on the new generation. And then the other segment is propane dehydrogenation, which is frankly an old technology that finally found its time because the US pricing of LPG is so much cheaper than the Middle East pricing. And so the beauty of that for us as LPG shippers is that there's no competition from naphtha. And so we've seen a lot of growth in that sector, particularly in China, but other places as well. So you know, I just add a little additional data to what Christian said about the versatility and the global nature of the demand for the product.
Thank you, Ted. Mads, do you have any additional commentary?
No, I think it's covered really well. I think the specialty, of course, for us is in the pet chems, where we transport the butadiene, the propylene, and the ethylene as well. It's mainly used in the production of plastics or rubber products. It's trading globally, and we load mainly in the US, where we have the, as I said before, the world's largest ethylene export terminal as well. So a lot of different grades that we are transporting, and most of it goes from the US to Asia and US to Europe. So it's long distance transportation. And they're very competitive when produced in the US because of the high production in the Permian Basin of natural gas liquids. And that means that a lot of ethane is in surplus, and that's being then cracked into ethylene and exported at an attractive price. So that's what we're benefiting from. It's an important and growing market, but we can come back to that in a little bit.
Great. Yeah, you guys have talked about the US a few times now, so I have a question related to that. I think the listening audience should be relatively familiar with the U.S. shale revolution, where the major unconventional oil and gas plays are within the country. In this low oil price environment, there's been some concerns around oil and gas production levels in terms of, drilled uncompleted wells and drilling activity, these types of things. So there's two dynamics here that I think people should care about. One is the absolute overall level of oil and gas production in the U.S., but then there's also the dynamic of how much infrastructure, especially regionally, comes into play with the ability to process and then fractionate the NGLs from the gas stream. So could you guys talk a little bit about how maybe either geology comes into play or regional infrastructure issues come into play, and how that's set up to benefit LPG or NGL production going forward, even if oil production stays relatively flat?
Shall I, Mads, you want to go or Christian?
Yeah,
Otherwise,
I
I'm
can
happy
give it
to.
a go here.
Yeah.
As mentioned before, we're loading about 60% of our cargoes in North America. So a larger proportion of that is in Texas. And the Permian Basin is very gas rich. It's a very important basin for the production of natural gas liquids in the US. It's very gas rich, so it does produce a lot of methane when you're drilling for oil in the Permian Basin, but it's also wet. And that means that it includes a lot of ethane, propane, and butane, so which together are called natural gas liquids. The more mature the basin gets, the wetter the gas. Let's say 3 years ago, the production of 1 barrel of oil in the Permian Basin would yield about half a barrel of NGL. In 2025, so just 3 years later, that number was 0.66 barrels. So it's up a real 33% just in 2, 3 years. If you ask Enterprise, our partner, they're the biggest pipeline operator in the US, they'll forecast 25% growth in US natural gas liquids production between now and 2030. So the growth prospects are really, really good. And all that additional natural gas liquid must be exported. And that's what the three of us here are doing. And again, Enterprise is investing about $6 billion into CapEx in the program to build out the export infrastructure. And these guys, they only build out the infrastructure when the offtake is in place. So it's real and it's coming, that growth. And that's just Enterprise, one large player, and there are, of course, others. But we see a very robust, you could say, production schedule of natural gas liquids out of the US.
Well
Well
great.
done.
Christian or Ted, do you have any follow-up to that?
No, I think there's always these questions about where you have the threshold on the crude oil price before it starts, at least in the short term, to reduce. I think we, from our experience, we understand it's around $50 to $55 a barrel, and you can still kind of maintain that crude oil production at the current level. I think it depends a bit from which basin you are talking about, but like Matt says, the most important thing is that as these wells mature, they become more and more gaseous. So the even though the crude oil growth is flattening out according to most expectations, the NGL production will continue to increase, which is what's important for us.
And I guess I'd say just to add a little bit, one is there's been a lot of discussion about declining oil demand, and it's been interesting in our sector without getting too far afield. But the significant growth in very large crude carrier orders suggests that some smart money is more bullish on the long-term prospects of oil than perhaps others say, and that's certainly a positive for our businesses, as both the guys outlined exactly what perfectly. And the other thing that I find interesting to Mads is right, the midstream guys do a fabulous job forecasting these things. And I think it's Targa who says over the next 5 years or 7 years, I guess, they see 23% growth in production of barrels and 32% growth in NGL production over the same time period. So just another statistic to underscore the gassy nature of the Permian in particular, and why I think we're all pretty bullish about the prospects for our business.
Right. How important, just generally speaking, are your commercial relationships with the midstream partners that you have, or downstream customers of the products? And what is your value proposition to charterers in this respect? And can you talk about the dynamics here? I think someone brought up 25 years fleet age or ship age at one point, but can you talk about dynamics related to fleet age? Is there a kind of differentiating or bifurcation of the market once a vessel reaches a certain age? Are there any disadvantages, let's say, other than operating costs of operating older, less efficient tonnage? And how does that play out in your markets?
I think Ted's for Ted and me it's slightly different than for Matt. So in our market it's the typical charters are the big energy majors like Exxon, Shell, BP, the big trading houses, Trafigura, Vitol, and so on. And then you have the big players in Asia, in Japan, China, and also the Middle East who are our charters. So it's not the export terminals or the midstream companies which are chartering our vessels. So I think and for us like any other shipping company, of course, the main our main value proposition is a safe, reliable, and timely loading and discharge of the charter's cargoes. And we operate very much in the market, which is quite similar to the tanker market actually, with a very dynamic spot market, day-to-day market where ships are fixed on single voyages, and then you also have a time charter market, which is or a period market, which is typically 1 to maybe up to 3, 4, or 5 years. But it's very, very different from the LNG market, for instance, where you have much longer contracts and historically at least have a less dynamic spot market. So I would say our market is quite similar to the tanker market in many ways. It's very dynamic, and of course the nature of the LPG industry, since it's a byproduct which has to be priced to clear in the international market, is driving the spot rates. I would say up and down if you look at the cycles, but it's a continuous flow of volumes both from the Middle East and the US over time, supporting the shipping demand that we benefit from as shipping companies. For Mats, it's a slightly different market dynamics. So,
Yeah, I mean, so the customers for us are also, you could say, big energy companies and trading companies, and then we also have the chemical producers as well that will time charter or spot charter our vessels. But those relationships are really important for us. I mean, the closer we can work together, the better we can organize the supply chain. And since much of our business is driven by arbitrage, less waste means that there's more money for freight and profitability. So that's of course in focus by both our customers and ourselves. And that's also why we as Navigator have invested into, you could say, a wider part of the supply chain by also owning or part owning terminal assets. In our segment and with the blue chip customers that we have, the vessels can operate until 25 years, and we do. Older vessels tend to tie up less capital, so that's good for returns. But on the other hand, we also see a little bit more downtime, a little bit more maintenance, and they tend to be a little bit less fuel efficient. So we prefer to have a good portfolio of vessels, both older and newer, so we can service, you could say, the different segments of our markets.
Let's turn to everyone's favorite topic, which is the shipping cycle itself, specifically in the LPG carrier segment. Can you guys talk about where are we at in terms of the order book to fleet ratio? Where are we at with the average fleet age? And where are we at within the cycle itself? It can be broken down overall or by your segment. And can you talk a little bit about the dynamics? I think people are familiar in the bulker segment and the tanker segment. There's a little bit of a waterfall effect in terms of the larger ships, the VLCCs impacting rates of the Suez and Aframax rates, or conversely, the Capesize rates in the bulker market impacting the sub-Cape rate. So how much does that dynamic play out within the LPG carrier segment?
I don't know, Matt. Well, I don't know. Matt, do you want to start with the last question?
Yeah, I mean, if I just take the full question from the top, say on supply and demand, we see pretty good dynamics here. We talked about demand, but on the supply side, we have about 8% of the sorry, about 10% of the fleet on the water that sits in the the new building book right now. So that's very benign. We actually think that over the past couple of years, we could see negative fleet growth in the handy segment simply because more than 20% of the ships are more than 20 years of age. So there'll be some scrapping, and the new building book is rather small. So from that perspective, it looks good. In the small gas segment that is smaller than ours, it's even more pronounced what I just mentioned here. If you look one step up into the mid-size segment, here the order book is much larger. There's been a number of ammonia vessels, fully refs, ordered over the past couple of years in anticipation of clean ammonia transportation, which has clearly drawn out. It takes a little bit longer than most expected. So here the order book doesn't look quite so good. The investments that we have done into that segment is mainly in the ethylene side, so which is a very small proportion of the mid-size segment, and that means it will not be competing with the ammonia mid-size carriers here. So I think all in all for Navigator, it looks pretty good in terms of the supply side. But yeah, I mean, there is a tendency if the order book is very large in the segments above you, that there can be some downward pressure in your segments. But I think we are largely insulated from that because we are focusing so much on the ethylene side where the order book is small.
Yeah, from a VLGC perspective, we're at 25% roughly order book to existing fleet. The interesting thing is our fleet as a sector has grown so massively on the back of the growth in U.S. exports from the fracking. And so, if you look back, say, I guess 12 years, I think the global fleet was right around 120 vessels. And we sit here today, we're, 413 thereabouts. So it's been pretty spectacular growth. And at the same time, the global fleet is continues to be a bit bifurcated in terms of its age. So we've got a substantial portion pretty close to the size of the order book over 20 years of age. Still sort of a bit of a barbell with a fairly young part of the fleet. The average global age of the fleet's around 11 years. So we sort of see the, nobody wants to have a big order book in his sector. But on the other hand, our order book's pretty well matched up with the export capacity that's coming on, which, as Mads correctly noted, is really tied to or is based on forward commitments from off-takers. So we feel all pretty good about the demand that's coming. And with the older ships, it's an interesting dynamic. The vast majority of them are really focused on the Iranian trade, which neither BW nor Dorian can touch for obvious reasons. So depending on what happens in this regulatory environment, so whether it's Iran being excluded from the world trade or Iran being invited back in, I think that the older fleet that serves them, which typically require more maintenance, they're very fuel inefficient. There's all sorts of oddities in their market. It would render a large part of that fleet generally obsolete. I won't say it'll disappear overnight by any stretch, but when you sort of start peeling back the onion on the global fleet and the order book, it's not as daunting as it might appear at first glance. And again, the fundamental growth in LPG demand globally provides a lot of comfort and cushion for our sector.
Great. We're running out of time here, so I do want to leave time for a Q&A. Nicholas, are you there, and can you access the Q&A?
Yeah, it's actually in the Zoom there, if you can see it at the bottom, Chris.
I cannot at the moment unless I point my finger towards my screen here, but if you guys have the questions, that'd be helpful.
Yeah.
Apologies for that.
Yep. Let's see here.
We can start at the top there.
Yeah, we
Amal.
could. Yeah. You want to go for you want to go
Yeah,
for it?
new ordering in the sector. I presume this is for all of us. New ordering in the sector is near 50 in 2025, 60% down year on year. Apart from high new building prices and surge in orders in previous years, was USTR and China special port fees responsible for fall in orders? And do you expect ordering to revive in 2026? I think for at least my view on the ordering, the pace of new building orders, so to say, in our segment, Ted, is that there was a surge in number of new buildings being placed back in 2024, early 2025, if I can remember correctly, and I think it's very much backed by a pretty solid freight market, underlying freight market, which has encouraged people to order ships, and also the fact that you have had a technology development which certain owners at least have felt attractive and kind of future-proof compared to ordering tankers and dry cargo ships, for instance. I think some of the new Greek ship owners we see entering our market, I also think have placed orders because of the dual fuel technology, which they felt was slightly more future-proof than the conventional propulsion technology that they were faced with in the tanker and the dry cargo sector. So it's a combination, I think, of market and technology.
If you want, I can take over the rest of the questions if you want.
Thank you,
Yeah.
Nicholas.
So we have a question for Navigator Gas. The petrochemical sector is consolidating in Asia and Europe with cracker shutdowns announced. What impact or restructuring is expected for the petchem seaborne trade and any positive effect from the Red Sea tensions resolving?
Thanks a lot. And if I just add a comment on the previous question around whether we'll see more ordering coming into the mid-size and the handysize segment, I don't expect that to be the case. I think this uncertainty about geopolitics is going to continue. And I think also people know and see that the markets for clean ammonia and for CO2 and so on, they'll be later, they'll be delayed compared to where we are today. So yard prices are high, etc. So no, I don't think that there'll be a resurging of new building in our segments as well. When it comes to the petchem sector consolidation that we are seeing in Europe, we already seen the effect of that. It means that a lot of naphtha to ethylene crackers, they are being closed down simply because they have not been profitable for a long time, and they won't be in the future as well. So they've been closed down, and that means that a lot of ethylene has to be imported from the US. So it goes into the polymer production in the European chain. So we will just see it as more transportation of ethylene from US to Europe. It's a little bit harder for me to see how it's going to play out in China. I still think that the geopolitics probably will overshadow much of the economics and the restructuring that we're seeing there. I think it depends a lot on where the relationship between China and US is continuing, whether we'll see more ethylene, more ethane export from the US into China. So the jury is still out on that one.
Can I add on that? One of the interesting facts about that consolidation and shift, which is good for probably for both sectors, is that the crackers that are being shut down in Europe, frankly, take a lot less LPG per year than the ones with which they're being replaced in Asia. So by some of the analytics we've seen, we're talking about shutting down plants with capacity of about, or demand for, let's say, 1.4 million metric tons of LPG per year. And the capacity that's going to effectively replace it in Asia is about 6.6 million metric tons per year. Now, these are flexible crackers, so that's sort of the maximum. But fundamentally, it should be more ton miles as this European capacity closes, which is really kind of an interesting secular development for our sector.
So we have another question that I will tweak a little bit. The question is it a good time to invest in the very large gas carriers? So I will expand the question and say, what is the best segment to invest in terms of ships? Very large gas carriers, medium size, smaller size? What do you think?
I can
Yes.
just start off answering for ourselves. We think it's, like I said initially, too expensive to invest in VLGCs at the moment. I think the smaller gas segments are still, I mean, I'm talking coasters now, below Matt's segment even is in a need for a renewal. But I'm not too familiar with the details of the age profile, but I know that the fleet is getting older globally, so.
Yeah, I think for handysize and mid-size vessels here, that building more new buildings now, we'd like to see the prices come down a little bit before we look into that. I think when it comes to consolidation, we are pursuing that. We're not so eager to pay cash for steel. We are more eager to pay with Navigator shares for so you could say bringing other vessels onto our platform. So that's really the strategy for us in when investing.
Thank you. Now, there was a very interesting question. What exposure do you expect to your fleet with the ban on open-loop scrubbers discharged from 2027 and closed-loop from 2029, especially when economics are favoring the scrubbers and LPG, DF? I don't know what DF is standing for,
A
but
fuel.
yeah.
Ted, do you want to give it a go?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, first, they've been great investments thus far. You know, vastly exceeded our internal calculations. We don't really have any open loop scrubbers because it didn't make sense to us back when, because you were just going to effectively, put the stuff back in the water, which kind of defeats the purpose. On the closed loop side, 2029 is kind of an eternity in shipping. Tough for me to say. I certainly think in our sector, we already see we've already got what four five six dual fuel LPG vessels. I think as you look forward, that percentage will increase. So I suspect that the overall impact, just on a percentage basis, will probably be somewhat mitigated just by the natural shift that we're seeing in LPG as fuel.
Yeah.
And
For
I think for just a quick one for BWLPG, we are tilting our fleet composition more and more towards LPG dual fuel. So that's kind of our strategy on the propulsion side. So just as a comment.
And same for Navigator. We are building dual fuel vessels, either ammonia and fuel oil or ethane and fuel oil. So we haven't considered scrubbers for a long time. We have a few in the fleet, but you could say the economics have been extremely volatile. And basically, I also think that it's probably better if the refineries, they are removing the sulfur rather than we do it on each ship. So fundamentally, I think it's fine that we close down that anomaly, and going forward, that we'll be going with the dual fuel vessels, which are much more environmentally friendly, and also the economics are good.
So, a kind of a related question here. What about carbon capture?
I mean, we've looked at carbon capture on and off for some time. The economics have not really worked. There are some smart people working on it right now, and I hope they can make it work eventually. But we haven't seen it as an economical way to reduce CO2 emissions. We have more looked into, you could say, the alternative fuel route.
Yeah, from a Dorian perspective, we probably concur, although we've made a small investment in a startup carbon capture business, which one of the other tricks is making them modularized enough to fit on board a ship. And the company in which we've invested is making good progress towards that. So still a ways to go, as Mod says. But it still doesn't entirely solve the problem. Even once you've captured the carbon, you still got to dispose of it. And so right now there are solutions out there, but they're pretty capital intensive to ship, build a CO2 carrier, ship it all the way up to Iceland or, Svalbard, I guess it is, of Norway, and inject it into the ground. So I think, the ultimate disposal of carbon still needs some work from an economic perspective.
So, since you allowed me to handle the Q&A, if I can ask one question of my own. We have seen on the LNG side the increasing flow of American LNG, especially towards Europe and elsewhere, which necessitates investments in FSRUs of course, increased utilization of ships to carry that LNG. Are we likely to see something parallel in the LPG sector?
Probably not.
No, I don't think so.
I
I
mean,
think
the volumes of LNG are much, much larger than the volumes that we are transporting. I mean, for us on the ethane side and so on. No, ours is much more niche.
also the infrastructure, the time it takes to build terminals for import terminals, for instance, for LPGs. And the price tag is complete, it's a different
Different
level,
world,
much, much
different
lower
dimensions.
than
Yeah.
LNG. So I think, even though you have some storage vessels in Indonesia and other places, and partly also shuttling between islands here and there in cabotage trades, but the infrastructure investments in LPG are much, much cheaper than what you see in LNG.
Thank you. So here is a question, I guess, a favorite question when it comes to publicly listed companies. Talk about the valuation in the gas carrier space, both price to NAV ratios of public companies in the space, and how do you think about the current asset prices of new versus used ships? So to rephrase the question, what about the valuation levels of in the gas carrier sector? Is that something that you would like to comment on?
I mean, from our perspective, when we calculate our net asset value, it's sitting around $28, and our stock is trading around 18. So there's a big discount there right now. But I mean, typically, I don't try to speculate too much about what our share price should be. I leave that over to the investors. So we are buying back our own share, right, stock right now, and we've done so for a number of quarters because we think we are generating value for our shareholders by doing share buybacks. So I guess that gives you a little bit of a hint on where we stand on this. When it comes to new versus used ships, yard prices have stayed relatively high, and we think probably our investment will more go into secondhand over the next couple of quarters.
And I think, I mean, Ted, you've been in this game a long time. Historically, the valuation has been typically, based on net asset values in shipping. I think over the last years, also because the shipping companies have managed to generate more steady income, basically, and profits, it's another school coming up. And I think, especially in the States, where it's more, based on earnings yield, dividend yield, while the Scandinavian valuation methodology is still probably more tilted towards net asset value. But I think you need to keep an eye on both to have to kind of shape your own opinion whether the share price is too high or too low. But to Matt's comment, I think it's up to the market to decide if you're correctly priced or not, after all.
But I think it's a good time, and we need Chris's help here to move, I think, towards a new valuation metric, not NAV anymore, maybe, on a P basis, cash flow, dividend yield, and so on, which is actually the metrics used in other sectors. So anyway, I think we have exceeded our time, but maybe one last question about the use of nuclear in do you think that this is something that will be considered
Yeah, well,
as a fuel?
not this side of the new year, I think, but maybe we need some more time to kind of develop that technology. But if you look at how it's being used for 50, 60 years in the various navies, I think you have icebreakers also in the Arctics, which have been fueled by nuclear for decades without any major incidents. So it will eventually come, I guess, but it will take time.
But probably in other segments before, because I think our segments here, I mean, we are much better suited for the likes of LPG, ethane, ammonia, etc., as future fuels. So I think it'll probably more be the container ships and so on where we'll see that first, but it'll take a long time.
And when you look at the shipyard landscape, that's another question. How do you see the shipyard landscape develop in terms of availability, technological capability, and so on for new ships going forward in your space? Any preference between Japan, Korea, China?
I think India is probably the new kid on the block there. So, I mean, historically, for gas carriers, the Korean yards have had a pretty firm grip on that market. The Chinese yards are definitely coming up to speed. I think we have at least a couple of new Chinese yards which are starting to compete both on quality and definitely on price. And then I think India is trying to develop their own shipping in building industry. It's going to take time for the Indian market, I think, but eventually I'm sure there will be an alternative.
Let's hope that happens, because I think that the shipping industry will benefit from having a this more diversified supplier base when it comes to the yards. I don't think it's in our interest to have China play as big a role as they do right now. Korea is big too, but I think it's important that we see more competition and more widespread competencies between the different nations. Right now, for gas tankers, China is very competitive, and so is Korea. Let's hope that there'll be more joining over the next couple of years that can build as efficiently and in high quality as we're seeing Korea and China do it right now.
Thank you. We had a lot of questions that were company specific, but we had discussed about this is a sector webinar rather than a company specific webinar. So I urge everybody who asked questions to come back to our company presentation series in January. Let me turn it over to Chris, and I'd like to thank each one of you for joining, and of course our participants. Chris, the floor is back yours.
Thank you, Nicholas. And my least favorite part of these webinars is that they have to end, unfortunately. I'm sure that we could all go on for hours here discussing the intricacies of this market. It's so dynamic with all the various products and chems, et cetera. I would like to thank the panelists today. Thank you, Nicholas and Capital Link, for hosting this webinar series, and we'll close it out there.
Thank
Thank you
you.
So
Thank you,
much.
Chris. Thank you, Capital Link.
Thank you.